pleasure to introduce Yasmin Bari, who is up from California, enjoying the weather. So Yasmin worked a lot with people we know here at Perimeter. She did undergrad work with Joel Moore, who is or was at PPRC at some point, and also her PhD advisor was Ashwin Vishwanath. So if you know these names, you know she's a condensed matter theorist. And a few years ago, I'd say 2.5, 3 years ago, when she finished her PhD, Yasmin was one of the first people to sort of strike out into this new field of, you know, for physicists and condensed matter anyway, machine learning. And so she's been working at Google Brain on the theory of deep learning and deep neural networks, and that's what she's going to talk about.
Thanks, Roger, very much for the introduction and for the invitation to speak here. Can everyone hear me in the back?
It's not amplified, right?
Okay, it's just recorded. Okay. I realize like the content of the talk might be very geared towards a machine learning audience, but I really would prefer to get through less material, but make sure that it's accessible to everyone. So please do interrupt me with questions. I'm going to try to augment the talk a little bit with some details so that hopefully even folks without any knowledge of deep learning can kind of get a sense of what the sorts of problems are that I and my collaborators have been working on. First off, I'd like to acknowledge all my collaborators. So the first part of this talk, which we I think will be maybe just the first portion that we'll get through, is based off of a collection of papers with the top group of people. And the second portion, which is very recent work that I'm very excited about, is with the four individuals on the bottom. We may not actually get to this portion, but I'm happy to tell you about it offline if we end up not.
Well, that's a comment. Oh, Hector was a Psi student here.
Yes, yeah.
Not relevant.
Yeah, I put up all the names and the pictures in case you recognize. Since many of them, the three folks in the bottom were high-energy theorists. Several of the folks in the top row were also high-energy theorists. Okay. So I and also my collaborators work more on, as Roger said, the theory of deep learning, more broadly the science of deep learning, so trying to fill the void between very rigorous theory that exists in machine learning and also just practice and empirics. And so we kind of want to try to understand neural networks from a more scientific perspective so that we can kind of guide design of these systems a little bit more intelligently. So they seem like complex systems, at least these black boxes that everybody is like working on, and everybody uses it as a tool, sort of as a black box tool, one in which we just put inputs and get outputs and don't really think about what goes on inside. Can we make more progress than that? And so although this is not the two things bullet points I've listed down here are, of course, like obvious to this audience, I think the approach that we take in theoretical physics or more broadly theoretical sciences is useful here. So we want to try to identify empirically phenomena within deep learning that's kind of universal enough to want to build theory for. And there are some problems here that conventionally computer scientists have always worked on, and we also want to understand those, but there may be even more questions that are useful to try to understand that others have not historically focused on. And then theoretically, the landscape is pretty open. So kind of if you think of maybe a lot of theoretical physics has come from an approach of exactly solvable models or fixed points, and then doing perturbation theory about that, and then also finding dualities so that we can map between very different problems. Maybe theoretically here, we're kind of in the within deep learning, we're in this early days where even taking limits of problems and having exact or semi-exact solutions is not something, it's not a way that people often think about problems. There are very few existing results. So that's kind of the approach we're gonna take here. So if you wanna identify a limit, where would you begin? So the place where we began and a lot of machine learning theory is focused on right now is over parameterized networks, and I'll explain why in a minute. So before I start, actually, how many people are pretty familiar with how many people aren't familiar with kind of deep learning, the paradigm of supervised learning, are all those words not? Okay. So maybe just very briefly, we're essentially kind of, we're trying to do high dimensional curve fitting. We're trying to solve a statistical problem if you want for right now before we talk about like anything more intelligent than that. The sort of problem we have is we have access to input output pairs, X and Y. That's what supervised learning means. You provide outputs, Y. So you're given, let's say the problem is the following. You're given X, Y pairs. N samples, and you want to learn the function that you want to learn this function, and you're going to parameterize it in some way where there are these parameters theta. Now, if you did like conventional statistics, you might use a linear regressor to kind of fit this. In the age of deep learning, we're going to use a deep neural network. So what's the new aspect here is that we're parameterizing this problem for certain sorts of tasks that we're interested in practice, like could be a vision task, could be a language task, et cetera. We're going to parameterize this in an interesting way as a neural network. So there are these parameters here. These we want to learn, or in this particular case, in this paradigm, what it means is that we construct some loss function, which is a function of these parameters. So we might kind of we might enforce this. Let me write the loss function like this. I might just construct this quadratic cost function on the n samples. Oh, this goes up. I might construct this quadratic cost function on the n samples. It's a function of the parameters that I need to learn. So just quadratic cost on the actual output of this function. And this function f, I didn't write it in explicit form, but let me draw it first diagrammatically. It's maybe a deep neural network before I invest time in actually writing out the parameterization. It takes input x, passes it through many layers. Each of these layers has free parameters that we're going to learn. Constructs a scalar output in this case, f theta of x, I, and all these free parameters are the things that we're going to learn via this optimization problem. And the goal here is that when I go and if I've done a good job on this problem, when I go and evaluate this function on some data that I've never seen before, so this is what people call generalization, then I should get pretty close to the right answer. So I haven't, if I've done a good job on this problem, I've learned the parts of the function, I haven't fit to the noise in these samples that I have, these XY pairs. I've kind of learned the underlying structure that is in this function. And the better, in some ways, a good parameterization here helps me do a better job at this. So finding a good match between the sorts of functions that we want to try to solve or fit and these sorts of like deep network parameterizations is part of what we want to try to understand better, and there isn't a lot of theory for it. Any questions about this? So this is kind of like a minimal setup that will help you understand supervised learning, and I will say that when people solve this in practice right now, so what do people do practice? F sub theta is a deep neural network. It consists of what I'm not going to write down, but basically a composition of affine transformations followed by pointwise nonlinearities done L times. So the transformation where I have, let me write Z I'll have some equations later on because I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but just in vector notation, I send X through an affine transformation, so weight matrix W, vector B. I pass, so let me call these actually alpha, beta, beta, alpha. So I keep repeating this procedure. I start with an affine transformation on X. These are X lives in some R to the D, for instance. So I multiply by a weight matrix, add in some, constant vector. I then pass it through phi. Here is a nonlinearity. I pass it through phi and then keep repeating this procedure. So this is the iteration. And when I do this L times, then I have a depth L network. Is that okay for anyone? And this is kind of just the vanilla example of a model that really only has depth structure and no other internal structure like convolution or things, some like notion of spatial degrees of freedom. And then when I go to solve this optimization problem, I run, I do it with gradient descent. So I just update kind of the parameters theta at time t plus 1 according to the gradient at time t. Any questions? That's the problem. That's kind of zeroth order. So I apologize for not having a slide on that. Okay. So back to where do you want to start understanding a problem like this? What can you say about this theoretically, about the optimization problem, about if I run the optimization problem, how well do I generalize? Where would you start if you were given this problem? So one place we started, which was kind of focused on, which was motivated by a collection of emerging kind of empirical results, was that this observation that when you when you make a network very overparameterized, meaning you just start to increase the number of parameters theta here relative to the number of samples n that you're trying to fit on, then you tend to do better. You optimize better, you generalize better. And now different ways of overparameterizing this problem have different effects. You can overparameterize due to depth. So I could have kept adding layers here after this to make it an even deeper network, but of the same width, where the width is kind of the size of these weight matrices that I'm multiplying in. Or I could have maybe fixed the depth and gotten over parameterization by increasing the width. And the focus of this talk is basically to tell you about kind of the highlights of 2-3 years of work, of my and my collaborators' work on what happens when you make. Okay, now the deep limit is another interesting one, I think, for study. But even this problem has been has gotten a lot of attention within theoretical machine learning. And so if you look at empirical trends, when you make these networks wider, they tend to generalize better. And this is what's shown here. So this is data from this problem that I described, where you train a model, you then test it on new samples, and you see how what that discrepancy between the test and the actual train loss is. And you find that it improves pretty monotonically. At least the best models tend to just keep on improving as you make these networks wider and wider. And when I say wide again, I mean that if I didn't write this, but if I thought of every hidden, these are called hidden layers. If I thought of every hidden layer as containing a certain number of hidden nodes, I'm just increasing the number there. So I take some d-dimensional vector, I project it into an infinite dimensional space. I'm going to take the infinite limit in a moment, but it's going to be infinite dimensional all the way down before I recover a scalar at the very end. So this is shown empirically here. Many other papers, I'll skip over these, kind of show the same result. Here, again, you see the error as the number of hidden units increases in a layer, and the error just goes down. And this is part of what people in machine learning call the mystery of generalization in overparameterized networks, because kind of the traditional statistical theory would tell you that you shouldn't have too many parameters for your model because you'll overfit. You'll learn the noise in the data. And that kind of, you might have that picture if you say we're thinking of like fitting to a polynomial. When you have a polynomial and you have a certain number of coefficients, every one of the coefficients, if you're truly using every one of those free coefficients to learn, to gather information from the data, then you are kind of at risk of overfitting. That's maybe like kind of the classical picture, where what you might associate classically with these older theories in statistical learning. But part of why it's not kind of true at a cartoon level in deep learning is that you also don't use all these parameters are not really free in some sense. They're constrained in some ways. When you update them and you run gradient descent backwards, many of the parameters could, in some sense, be staying random or semi-random. And so they're not acquiring all the information that you might have worried about. Like the effective number of parameters in terms of information content that is learned is actually not as bad as you would have thought. And so that's part of what this mystery is. We want to have theory for this sort of setting where we have overparameterization, we have a richer class of models to think about, and we want to understand why we can learn well in these regimes. So given these empirical results, it's natural to ask what happens, because all of these trends showed kind of monotonic improvements with width, what happens when you take the limit of infinite width in all of the layers? So again, fixed depth network, all hidden layers are going to be infinitely wide. Any questions on this so far?
But the training time would go to infinity, right?
Not necessarily.
Yeah, but if you want the machine to touch all the parameters,
we don't require that. We just require that. I think you're right that if you required that, that might be true. But what you really just require, what you do is you just minimize this loss. And when it's overparameterized, you'll be able to get basically zero loss. You don't need to touch all the parameters or really deal. And it is sort of true that in these infinitely wide networks, a lot of the parameters are basically just random. And we don't, I think, really understand what role they play in terms of actually reducing your susceptibility to noise. Because you could imagine, like, if I have, maybe they absorb, when you pass in an input, it actually kind of absorbs noise in a way, in a certain way, to give you actually a cleaner output. So to answer your question, we don't require that we necessarily are fully learning all these parameters. We're just running gradient descent on this optimization problem until convergence, where convergence means zero loss, which happens actually pretty rapidly. It's a time that doesn't grow with the number of parameters empirically.
So what does it mean if you say your parameters are random? It's like, does it mean the part of the neural network where the parameters are random dies out, get disconnected from the rest of the neural network?
No. So, I should say, when we, maybe to go back to what the protocol is, when you solve this optimization problem in practice, you start with basically no knowledge of what the right setting of the parameters are, so they're initialized at random originally. So these weights and biases here originally at the beginning of optimization are just drawn, say, from some distribution, oftentimes like a normal distribution, Gaussian distribution, let's say. And then you update them as you optimize this problem.
Yeah.
And when you update them, some of them will be learning more than others. Along certain directions that are determined by the data, you're going to learn a lot. Or along other directions, you might not learn so much. And so if you were to look at, say, how much some of those parameters maybe change, or maybe they change, but they stay sort of random, then it's in that sense that I mean that they don't really acquire as much information as you might have worried about from the data.
Okay, then can we make this more concrete in a sense? If you compare the number of parameters that have a contribution to the decision of the network, does this number scale as the number by which you increase?
That's right. Yeah. Okay. No, it doesn't. So it kind of saturates. I don't know that anybody's done this experiment, but like based on the exact solutions that we have now, I think that it's sort of like it's a number that's dependent on the complexity of the task, but not a number that scales with the number of parameters. So it's not going to infinity. It kind of saturates at some level that's needed for this problem.
Thanks.
So are you saying that if you start with randomly initialized parameters, mm-hmm. and then run gradient descent, mm-hmm. empirically, most of the coefficients of the gradient will be zero?
I'm saying if the network is very wide, this is exactly true in the infinite width limit, that many of the directions just do not update, or many of the parameters will not change much along directions that you could kind of specify, then that's true. And I think as you then make the network not infinitely wide but finite, there's a sense in which that kind of carries over perturbatively. Any other questions? So before we go on to kind of the rest, I also want to say something that, again, may be trivial for this audience, but was not as trivial, I think, for the machine learning community in terms of frame of mind or how they think about problems, which is that parameters here are sort of like a choice of gauge. I mean, it's just a parameterization, if you like. And the thing that's physical for you at the very end, although you run the optimization problem on the thetas, the thing that you really have that is physical for you is the function value that's produced at the end of this whole like deep network, right? And so thinking more about what sort of function class you are representing at initialization, or you have access to represent with just a little amount of learning, I think is a more, it kind of gives you a nicer, maybe more useful way of looking at the problem than if you took a very parametric point of view. So a lot of like traditional optimization, it is just focused on the parameters. Here are parameters, we want to learn them. How can we do that in a way that guarantees convergence in a certain amount of time, right? But if we take this function kind of point of view, what class of functions are we biased towards when we start training? Because we are biased towards a certain class when we choose a model in this way, and then we draw parameters at random, we kind of have a bias. There's a certain class that we can represent very easily. And maybe with just a little amount of work, we can represent a slightly different class also pretty easily. And so this just keeping track of these functions is, I think, was one of the things that we kind of did in this line of work that was useful in changing, I think, the mindset of the community. And this is also because parameters also in these sorts of, in a neural network, were not really introduced to be interpretable. So in like maybe conventional like statistical, in conventional statistics, oftentimes maybe you're dealing with very macroscopic variables and you'll say, oh, I think I should fit this with a linear, you know, linear regression or something like that. And that's based on kind of a notion of, you have some, then when you introduce parameters, you often do it in a way that's interpretable. You know, but here I just kind of over-parameterized the problem quite a bit. I didn't tell you, I don't really have any physical sense for what the weights in an early layer or deeper layer should correspond to. So there's a high amount of redundancy. There's not really any physical meaning to them. The thing that's physical is the function. So that's what we want to try to say something about theoretically. Okay, so this is supposed to be a little bit of a survey part. So what happens when you take this infinite width limit? Let's go back to talking about initialization, because that's a key part of this whole program, right? We have a certain class of functions that we have access to when we initialize the parameters randomly, and then when we train, if we could track what that class is, theoretically, then we've made a lot of progress. So how do people in practice, as I said, initialize neural networks? What they do is what's shown here on the third line. They will initialize them from an IID distribution. So all these weights, let me now be more specific. The parameters we really want to talk about are, let's say, the matrix elements of all the weight matrices in all the layers. So L indexes the layers, IJ are the matrix elements, as well as these bias components. This is the collection of all parameters that we're gonna keep track of in the optimization. Now, what happens in practice is we draw these randomly IID from some distribution. And what's crucial is actually that we draw these according to a distribution where the variance here of every weight matrix element scales as the inverse of the size of the layer. Okay, so n in here, you can just drop the in subscript. N is just going to be, I apologize for switching notation again from up there to here, but n is going to be the width, and we're going to take n to infinity. Okay, so the reason we do this is if you look at this sort of computation, this is the computation that I wrote down for what a deep network does from layer to layer. So I give it input x. At some point, there's some signal z. Z was the signal coming into a hidden layer here. After L minus 1 layers, so z to the L minus 1 is some vector that lives in this infinite dimensional space, because j is going to run to infinity. I pass it through the nonlinearity phi. I multiply again by this weight matrix w. I add in this component, and this produces the new signal for the next layer. So because of this form, if you think about the contribution of, if you think about what happens when this n goes to infinity, I'm summing over infinitely many random variables. Because these weights, these w's are all drawn, they're random variables, and they're all IID. And when I initialize them in a way that scales, where the variance of each component scales as 1 over n, then I guarantee that the variance of this quantity z to the L is order 1, right? Imagine computing the variance of this thing. And this variance is also of order 1. So this sort of scaling of variance, scaling is the inverse 1 over n, gives me kind of a finite variance output, which allows me to continue to propagate this this computation forward at initialization. Is that okay to follow?
It's okay to follow, but it's weird. Because it means that for large layers,
yeah,
it's going to be really small.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
So that means that in order to actually get this finite output, then you have to recruit a lot of the layers.
Exactly, yeah.
So how come then, when I asked you earlier that most of the components of the gradient are going to be zero,
mm-hmm.
meaning that we are not recruiting far out pieces of the layer.
Mm-hmm. You're not going to, so I think you would see that later on where you looked at, although each one is infinitesimally small, you want to track like the actual change in each one. And some of them will change basically, all of them will be reduced by the like 1 over n kind of. So none of them will like move, but then some of them will move more than others in ways that are dictated by the data. So I think in that sense, maybe like some of them are more important than others, or you don't amass kind of the entire, it's not like a full rank kind of update to all the W's. It's along certain directions. But the thing that you noticed is crucial to basically the rest of the story. To maybe piggyback off of what you said, the fact we initialize in this way because we want to have control over how the signal propagates when it goes deeper. So we need to go as 1 over n so that we have order 1 in the output. But then as we make it wider and wider, each weight participates less and less. You get a very nice, well-defined limit when you take n to infinity, which is going to be basically this slide in the next view. And then it also very much constrains the dynamics in a way that actually makes the problem, regularizes the problem to essentially be convex in some sense. And so that is kind of part of why making the, it's in some sense a regularization that we've imposed kind of on the problem from this choice of scaling that made it less bad than you might have thought. You might have worried, okay, maybe as I make it wider, I get like widely varying gradients, updates to the parameters, et cetera, but it all comes from this sort of scaling. And this is something that's only recently been appreciated, even that how you choose the scaling then dictates what happens in the limit and what sort of limit would you want to have. It's not even clear, but this one will bias you towards a very nice optimization problem in the infinite width limit.
Why do you say it becomes effectively convex? Is that because you have so many dimensions that you are super unlikely to have a local minimum?
So it becomes effectively convex in that, like, when you write down the solution that you, the effective loss landscape that you're going to navigate, it's just like a convex problem. It's not maybe a global statement about everything that you could access. It's more like an effective statement in that, like, given this initialization and given that I run gradient descent in this infinitely wide network, I'm only going to explore this region. And so I regularized it, but I don't know about this other parts of the landscape. I could maybe perhaps access them, but I don't end up accessing them practically. Is that okay?
Is that true only for Gaussian processes, or is it true in general?
This did you say Gaussian processes or Gaussian initializations?
Gaussian processes, so the way you navigate.
So there are two things. Maybe like you don't need the fact that it becomes a Gaussian process in this infinite width limit comes from just the application of the central limit theorem and this 1 over n scaling. But you don't need these individual distributions to be drawn normally. So like you could choose, as long as you, so whatever, you can relax the condition enough so that you can apply central limit theorem and then you'll get a Gaussian process. With respect to these normal distributions that I've written up here, or at least specifically this one, you could have chosen a different distribution, but drawn the parameters IID and still applied the central limit theorem and then gotten a Gaussian process. Now, if you're asking how can I break the Gaussian process limit entirely, you can do that by breaking this 1 over n scaling. And people, there are maybe like a few old papers that I know of, actually this very first one from the 90s, that had considered this, but in practice, people have not considered this. And so one question is, for the sort of task that you want to try to solve, is a Gaussian process limit in infinite width a good one for your problem? Because if it's, you might want to bias the problem then towards a different class of functions. But the ones that, because of the scaling, conventionally almost all like neural networks will be going towards is this Gaussian process one. So then the conclusion from this slide is that when you have this prior over parameters that's IID and you take the limit of infinite width, you're going to be summing over infinitely many IID random variables, conditioning on the inputs x. So imagine I can make a kind of conditional argument. I condition on the inputs x, then condition on that at each layer as I take the width to be infinite, I'm going to get a Gaussian process. And conditioning on the output of that previous Gaussian process, I'm going to pass it again through something that's a sum over IID random variables and get a Gaussian process again. This is kind of cartoonish argument, but it can be made rigorous. And so the distribution that you get at the very end is one in which the output at any of these, at any layer that you like, but in particular at the very end, the scalar output that's computed, after layer L, at any hidden node I, it's governed by some Gaussian process with a covariance function, which is kind of the heart of the computation that's being done here. And I haven't written down explicitly. So this is just notation for Gaussian process. In our particular case, it's going to have mean zero. It doesn't have to necessarily. And we're just going to focus on the covariance function k. And what we can write down for the covariance function here, so this is, because everything is mean zero, by this k, I mean, this expectation could be any hidden node that I take. This expectation value over the randomness of the parameters. That's the definition of k to the l. And there's a recursion relationship that you can write down coming from knowing that the previous layer also was governed by a Gaussian process with a different covariance function, k to the l minus 1. So this looks complicated, but it's just like a 2D Gaussian integral. So you can actually do this and write down an explicit recursion relationship for how you propagate forward, basically these like second moments corresponding to the computation done by the, if you like, Gaussian field theory that you're getting. Is that okay for everyone? So this is still no training. We're just talking about initialization. But then we're going to be able to make statements about training in a little bit. So this is just to highlight kind of the computation that's being done. What you have on the left is the computation I said is done by a deep neural network. You start with some input x, some d-dimensional vector, affine transformation. You continue to propagate this forward to get some z to the l of x. When you take the infinite width limit, basically this gives you a mapping between these covariance functions. So you have some base case k0, which comes from computing the covariance basically of the input, the inner products of the inputs, and you propagate that forward to k to the l. And so you have a complete description of the distribution over functions at initialization for an infinitely wide network. This is like what people call a prior. We took a prior over parameters and turned it into a prior over functions, or a distribution over parameters into a distribution over functions. Okay. I won't spend maybe too much time on this slide to kind of maybe hit a few of the other highlights. I'll just say that one of the things that, so what was done before and what did we do? I'll say that people, so Radford Neil, in a very nice paper in the 1990s, had figured out that a single hidden layer network is governed by this Gaussian process when you take n to infinity. But nobody had worked on what happens in the deep case, how to basically do this recursion and write down the recursion relationship for the covariance functions for deeper networks. And also people had forgotten about deep learning. So when deep learning made a comeback, it was kind of, I think, the time was ripe to revisit this kind of correspondence. And so we did this 2 years ago, as did another group, when people started working on over-parameterized networks again. Now, once you map something to, if you like, a Gaussian process or a Gaussian field theory, then if you want to train with this quadratic loss, this is going to go essentially in some exponent of something. So you can imagine you're going to have like e to the minus a quadratic in this function. And then the function itself is drawn according to a Gaussian process. And you're going to need to do some integral. I'm just highlighting kind of the notation that's written here without describing what it is. But it's just going to be, the integrand is going to be all Gaussian integrals, or Gaussian integrand, which you can then do the integral for and get an exact result for what the prediction for some new point is given some what the model prediction is. So the model prediction, I'm going between the Z's and the F's, so I apologize. But you can get a prediction for the output of the model given some new test point X star. So remember, what did we want to use this for? We trained on some data set D consisting of XY pairs. We trained the model, And now when we want to do prediction, we give it some new point x star, and we want to know what is the model output. And so these Gaussian integrals that I didn't write down essentially correspond to, I give you a Gaussian field theory, if you like, which is my prior over functions. It's a class that I think is good for the problem. And then I'm going to try to fit it with this quadratic loss, if you like. So if you imagine it as kind of a pinning potential, if you want, on these n data points, I have some like Gaussian field. I'm going to try to pin it at some of these points to the target values. And then I'm going to be able to infer what the value of the function is at some other test points. That's sort of what's happening in these in this integral here. This is not something that people commonly do because they don't commonly do Bayesian inference in function space. They do it in parameter space. And if you had written down the parameter space version of the problem manifestly, you might not have noticed that it has this very simple form of just dealing with Gaussian fields and a pinning potential. So it's one of the advantages that you kind of gain when you think about the functions or the field rather than thinking about the parameters of the neural network. Is this any questions about this? Okay, so this is, you know, with other cost functions, it's going to be difficult to get an exact solution. And so this is why people don't do this like kind of field theoretic approach to Bayesian inference that often. But the simplicity of this answer was sort of what hinted at why maybe there are other like simple answers for other forms of training in this infinite width limit. Okay, so is Bayesian inference actually something that people are familiar with? Okay, so my apologies if that was very redundant. So this is just summarizing what I said. With a square loss, you can do Bayesian inference exactly. One of the things that we observed actually when you did this Gaussian field pinning thing or Bayesian inference, if you liked, is that the performance of such a model that's infinitely wide that you kind of do implicitly via thinking about the function rather than actually updating all the parameters was sort of similar in performance to a finite width neural network trained in some other way. And so it kind of makes you wonder, well, maybe this infinite width limit doesn't have such a bad performance, although these are two different training methods that I'm telling you about. And indeed, what ends up happening, a lot of the work since then has been about, you know, we can implement the infinite width limit answer or make some predictions exactly using these Gaussian fields. And then we can compare them to finite width neural networks and try to figure out if this Gaussian field theory, if you like, is actually a good theoretical description for what's going on at finite width. So the rest of the talk will be instead not about Bayesian inference, but it will be going back to the problem that I talked about here, which is you have some optimization problem and you're going to run gradient descent. And you want to be able to say something about the dynamics of this class of functions under gradient descent or gradient flow. Okay, so this is one thing that I think was a really fascinating result from about a year and a half ago, which has to do with basically this Jacot et al. Solved the problem of dynamics in the infinite width limit. In some ways, based off of this idea that like in the infinite width limit, you have a Gaussian process, and so thinking about the functions, and if you track that, if you just look at the dynamical evolution of the functions, it might have some simple form, kind of led them to this result. But I want to maybe take a different point of view on it, which is one that's apparent in hindsight, which is let's try to say something about the evolution of the functions that's induced by evolving the parameters, right? So the parameters were just, they're these variable, they're kind of maybe a choice of gauge again. What's physical is this evolution of z of x, dz of x dt. So the evolution of the parameters doing the continuous time case here, this is just the equation for gradient flow, d theta I dt, I runs over 1 to infinity, it's going to run through 1 to, from 1 to infinity, is just minus the learning rate, or the step size, if you like, times the gradient, dl, so l is that loss function, dl d theta sub I, which I can just trivially rewrite using chain rule. as dl dz, the derivative of the loss with respect to that output, because here, let me actually, to make things cleaner, let me just call this z. It's the final scalar output. So the loss is only sensitive to that, to the final output z. That's the only thing it sees. So I could write this as dl dz evaluated on all my data points x sub a times dz, the gradient, the derivative of z with respect to the parameters. This is the portion that comes from the neural network. This is the portion that's just plugged in from the loss. Okay, and I run this over a in my data set. A indexes the data points. Now, if I look at the evolution equation for the function dz of x dt, I also use train rule. So I have a derivative. The function changes because the parameters change. And then here's the evolution due to the parameters. I'm going to plug this in here and factor out this portion, dl dz of x sub a. And then this sum over I, which ran over all the parameters I, and they're going to be infinitely many, is going to be pulled into this parentheses here. This is a trivial rewriting, but what you see is if I redefine this quantity as big theta, and I apologize for the kind of redundant notation, so little theta are the parameters, big theta is just this quantity that I've redefined in parentheses. If I define that to be the case, then I see the equation takes this form, that the function evolves due to some cost that's imposed by the loss times this object here, which is, again, it's actually kind of like a two-point function. It's a kernel or a covariance function. It's coming from this inner product over the gradients. X is some arbitrary point I want to track. It could be anything. And X sub A here runs over the data set. But what it highlights is that there's some object that I can track, which is this big theta, some kernel, which is dynamical. It's a function of time. And it's a function of just the two inputs, X and X prime. And all of the evolution is coming from there. Now, the problem with this equation is that by itself, it doesn't do much. Theta itself is a dynamical variable, so I need to write down an equation for its evolution. And if I were to do that, what I would find is that in turn is governed by some other operator. You could call it O prime, which is actually a function of three inputs, and so on, if I continue to differentiate. And so this gives me like a hierarchy of coupled differential equations that I would need to solve, so I haven't made any progress in actually rewriting it in this way in function space. But the amazing thing is that if you write down the evolution equation for theta, this big theta, so d theta dt, and you look at how those scaling factors that I talked about at the very beginning, the 1 over n's, that came from the scaling with the size of the hidden layer. If you look at how those appear in this equation, they appear as like 1 over n. So in the infinite width limit, d theta dt equals 0. So theta just does not evolve in time. And so if you imagine this thing, let's say we did quadratic cost again. So dl dz is going to be linear in z. And here we have kind of just a derivative of z. This is a linear differential equation. I can solve it exactly and get an exact solution to the dynamics in this limit, because this thing is frozen, actually, and not a dynamical variable. And this object is called the neural tangent kernel, was given a name by these folks. And sort of understanding for a real network, the evolution of this object is kind of part of the, would help illuminate kind of what's going on in networks that are not infinite. So to jump ahead to a little bit other things that I wanted to mention, as you start to move away from the infinite width limit, you can imagine doing a sort of perturbation theory on this problem in 1 over the width. And what ends up happening is that this hierarchy that I mentioned, where you start with you started with this top level equation, and then you needed to write down evolution equations for all the things that are generated down the line, like these operators. It turns out that if you work perturbatively in the width, that you can effectively truncate this at some level. So at some lower level, the evolution of some object will be essentially zero or negligible compared to the order that you want to work in. And then you will then again have some effectively closed system of equations that you could try to solve. So that's sort of the picture that's built off of solving the infinite width limit and then doing perturbation theory about it to get some kind of approximate set of differential equations that describe the dynamics of the network without really talking about the dynamics of the parameters, because we don't care what they are and they might be more complicated. Any questions about that? How am I on time? Well, so I'll jump ahead a little bit. I'll just say that actually the evolution of the parameters is simple in this limit also. Without going really into the details, it turns out that if you have this evolution that I talked about on this slide where theta is does not evolve and is just frozen at its initial value, then that actually corresponds to just doing a first-order Taylor expansion of the neural network about its initialization with respect to the parameters. So just these things are just evaluated at init and not trained. If you trained that model, that would be effectively the model that you are realizing when you train an infinitely wide network. There are infinitely many parameters, but it amounts to just some problem that's linear in its trainable parameters. So you know, you might imagine, to maybe give some of the highlights of the rest of the story without actually going through it, this infinite width limit corresponds to some first-order Taylor series of the function about initialization, where you just do the first-order Taylor series and then train that. And you could imagine going to higher order in Taylor series and asking, does that describe the if I trained that model, would I recover the dynamics of a nonlinear neural network that I care about? And part of the story that I wanted to tell you about in the second half of the talk, which we won't really get to, is that actually that is not, even that Taylor series expansion will not describe the dynamics in regimes that people often use in practice. And so it's to describe the dynamics of what people, of regimes that are of great interest to practitioners, you're going to have to do something very non-perturbative. It's not going to be gotten from a Taylor expansion about initialization. There's going to be some initial evolution that breaks this perturbative expansion. And then if you do perturbation theory after this period, which we call a rearrangement in our recent work, and then do a linear first-order Taylor expansion or a higher-order Taylor expansion about that second period, then you will recover the dynamics of these very nonlinear models in regimes that like people have not been able to theoretically describe before. And so one of the I guess before I will come back to that in a minute, I will just show you some data, which is that if you asked how well is a nonlinear model that's very wide described by this training of the first order Taylor series, you would find that, of course, because it's a Taylor series that's taken about initialization, it will describe your dynamics up to some time. If the network were infinitely wide, that would be all of time, and that would be it. If the network is finite, it describes you up to some time. And here, this is indeed a finite width network. It's pretty complicated and has bells and whistles that people care about. And you see that like it actually, so it's the difference between the dashed and the solid lines. You see a good agreement between the linearization and the nonlinear model up to these late times. But eventually, you're going to see some discrepancy. So this is just an example of what I was describing. Maybe I won't talk about this, but I kind of talked about it in spirit, which is that for the regime that people really want to try to now understand theoretically, since we understand the infinite width limit, is finite width networks that then might be very hyperparameter optimized. So a finite width network, as I said, you could ask, is it described by some higher order Taylor series? So if I go out to more orders, will I describe the dynamics? And it turns out that one of the knobs that really controls how well, whether that's true or not, is the choice of step size or the choice of learning rate. And so this was kind of the content of the second part of the talk. One of the things we find, or based on some of our both recent experiments and a simple class of models that we kind of propose and study, we find that depending on the choice of step size in gradient descent, so this was the eta that I wrote down when you actually do not gradient flow, but gradient descent. So you take these finite size step sizes. So what happens in practice is that people tune this parameter eta a lot. So they will often try to, they'll do sweeps, they'll take a model, they'll run gradient descent, but they'll do it with varying with different choices of step size, and they'll see what they get. And oftentimes, you know, the dynamics that you basically have access to ends up being very dependent on how you set this learning rate parameter. And one of the results that we've just kind of understood very, very recently is that, so first I want to just emphasize, this is going back to the parameters. The equation I'm running is, this is just the gradient descent update in parameter space with step size eta. And I'm going to tune eta. I have a, eta is something that I can choose. So I can set it to different values. And one of the things that you find is that depending on, if you imagine eta as something that runs from basically zero, when you choose eta that's too large for this gradient descent problem, so eta max, the problem just blows up, it diverges. And that's because when you take, when you just do like a, when you just evaluate the gradient, but you take a step size that's too large for the geometry of like this landscape, then you just go off into some direction that's not good for you. Okay, so there's an eta max. And this is if you were training the fully nonlinear problem. This is what you would observe. So in a nonlinear, fully deep nonlinear model, you find everywhere up to this max eta, you can train. Now, what we discovered was that actually you can separate eta into two different regimes in this regime. So here I want to say eta out here, as I said, leads to divergent dynamics. You cannot train. There's an eta over here, which I'm calling eta critical. And it's the eta, basically, it's an eta below which a perturbation theory sort of holds. This Taylor series expansion, if you did it about initialization and you chose an eta that's small enough here, you're effectively going to track the Taylor series of the problem. So this region, I'm waving my hands a little bit, but that's kind of that's the picture that effectively emerges. This is what we call, and other people have studied, we call this the lazy phase of learning, because it's close to this Taylor series kind of expansion, you know, where you basically don't update the parameters that much, or you stay kind of close locally to the solution you started out with, to the model you had at initialization. And then what happens out here is something very non-perturbative, which we now call we termed it the catapult phase. And these two actually have a sharp phase transition between them in the infinite width limit. So that's one of the things that we built up a lot of empirical evidence for, but then in a very nice and elegant kind of class of models, revealed that there was actually a sharp distinction between these two phases as n goes to infinity. And then at any finite n, what ends up happening is that you kind of get a crossover between these two regimes. But that distinction becomes pretty sharp as n goes to infinity. And so this other phase of training is one where the dynamics is very different from this phase. It's basically non-perturbative with respect to, at least in the infinite width limit, with respect to the initialization. But if you wait a little bit of time and then do perturbation theory after this kind of some amount of rearrangement has happened, then you kind of recover perturbation theory if you expand about that point. So this is basically the picture where we've tried to build up is like a phase diagram for the dynamics of neural networks, where the important parameter here is learning rate. It's a parameter that practitioners tune all the time, but they don't really have a good sense of what it does, how it controls the model that you end up learning. And we're basically saying that when you're in this regime, you learn a model that we understand based on the infinite width limit results, or one that is like perturbative about initialization. And when you tune to this regime, and this is a finite regime, so it's not a it's not something that's vanishing, it's like a size order one regime. When you tune to this regime, you have access to a much wider and different class of learned models. That's where the real, if you like, real learning is happening, when you tune to this regime. And when you sit here, you essentially sit, if you like, close to the Gaussian process or Gaussian field theory plus corrections. So that's the, you know, I think I'm almost out of time and probably I would need to go into a lot more detail. One of the things that we did was there's a simple model that basically has these three phases in it. It gives some predictions for where these transitions happen. And even though this model is super simple, we can actually solve it exactly and then refine it a little bit. The predictions for where these transitions happen, we tested them in real models. And they, you know, real models with data and bells and whistles and all the like architecture, and it holds up pretty well. And so, you know, basically, from theory, we're able to tell practitioners something that they didn't know before. For what is a very non-convex optimization problem, we can tell them roughly what scale, how you can know roughly what this number is from a measurement at initialization, how you can know what this number is from a measurement at initialization, and therefore that you should choose eta to lie in this regime if you want access to this other class of functions or other sort of model. So probably I'm out of time, I think. And so I'll just end there. All the things I wanted to go through. And thank you, yeah, for your time.
Well, an intuition seems to emerge here. Let me see if I get that straight. So in order to do information processing, we generally need some nonlinearity. For example, in electronics, that's provided by a transistor. If we didn't have one, we couldn't get computers. Now, in neural networks, my understanding has been that it's the activation function that provides the nonlinearity. Mm-hmm. However, when you have your parameters smaller and smaller, the nonlinearity goes away, basically, mm-hmm. because you can approximate it by a constant function, by a linear function, the mm-hmm. activation function. So what I'm wondering is that how you get the nonlinearity in again, namely by having your eta larger than a certain critical value, which, you know, if it was too small, you're still in the linear regime. But mm-hmm. if you make it larger, then you get nonlinear. Is that how, in a backdoor way, you get nonlinearity again in the infinite widths?
So that's an excellent question. I think that, but to go back to your first statement, I think that that's not true, that the nonlinearity plays no role in the computation. And that's because actually where you kind of linearize deep in a network will depend kind of on the input X. And so it's not that it doesn't just throw away the nonlinearity. So here, if you imagine you Taylor expanded, it's something that's linear in the parameters. But there's a computation here that's done on the inputs that's still nonlinear. And so these gradients and effectively the sort of covariance function that I wrote down earlier, which is related to this other object, the NTK kernel, they're all nonlinear computations of X. At least effectively, they look nonlinear. Now, maybe they're like smart reductions of that. But you still are doing a nonlinear computation on x, just not on theta. Now, there is something interesting that happens with the nonlinearities, and particularly for certain classes of nonlinearities in this other regime that I mentioned, which we still don't understand yet. So they play a much larger role in this initial rearrangement period, where they're turning on and off, fluctuating very widely. And then when you like go through that period, you effectively stabilize some of the values, and then you can think of doing like a linearization after that time to effectively recover the dynamics. So the role of the nonlinearities is pretty different in these two phases, but I wouldn't say that this phase necessarily has gotten rid of the nonlinearities. And that's, in terms of theory, that's actually one of the things that I really, I think is interesting about this approach, which is that we didn't try to toss out the nonlinearities because, you know, many models, theoretical models might just try to do a linear network, like linear in the parameters, or do this deep thing, but get rid of all these pointwise nonlinearities here. And this is, you know, this is what makes this very mathematical. This makes it very like unnatural from a physics point of view, I think, to have these pointwise nonlinearities applied on top of these affine transformations. So it makes it harder to kind of treat. But one of the nice things about this infinite width limit and thinking about like Gaussian field theory is that you didn't have to toss that out. That's like encoded in the computation of these recursion relationships for the covariance tension.
Stop.
So I have a question about this learning rate phase diagram. So the first one is, how do you compute the gradient of the loss function? Is this with stochastic gradient descent? Do you use batch? So I could imagine that you probably have some sort of phase diagram in terms of the batch size.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so that's a different project we're actually working on, but other people have worked on that as well. And it's true that so this phenomenon that I described, we've studied it at the level of, it's a phenomenon that is pretty robust to the choice of batch size in the sense that it's like a full batch effect. So for all of our experiments that we did, we chose different batch sizes, but they're effectively large enough so that we don't have to worry about additional noise coming from the batch size. But I also think that that might be a little bit, so it does affect what this is here, the choice of batch size when it becomes very small. But I also think that it's a little bit of a higher order effect on top of this one, which is pretty different and pretty orthogonal to the role of batch size. Does that help? Does that answer your question? Or
so which magnitude you are talking about, like the size, the typical size of your batch size?
Say that again.
Like the size of the batch that you take, the order of magnitude.
Oh, what is it? It's large. So it's, you know, like hundreds of samples. What order of magnitude is good depends on the problem.
Yeah.
Because like when the batch size is large enough, you've effectively saturated kind of the information content that you would have had you done like full batch. In practice, it's like maybe order 100 samples or 1,000 samples. But you could imagine we could do this for a full batch problem. Just run every gradient descent step on the full data set. And we can predict what these zetas are. And these things are kind of independent of the batch. You're right that the batch, when it becomes very small, then has an effect on this thing. Yeah.
One more.
So how's the depth factor into the story? Like we're talking about like the depth has anything. And if it doesn't have anything, then that means we can easily transfer this to the recurrent set.
I missed the last part of what you said.
If the depth doesn't have any meaning, then we can easily transfer this to the recurrent set.
The recurrent setting, one difference is that the weights are tied across the layers and like mathematically, so that's still a bit different than the IID kind of every layer being independent thing that I talked about. But other people have since worked on trying to extend some of these Gaussian process things for recurrent networks. With respect to the role of depth, so that's an excellent point. It seems like it plays no role. In the infinite width limit, when I wrote down the recursion relationship for the covariance function or the two-point function, So depth there plays, you know, then governs how many times you're going to iterate that forward, and therefore that's changing the final function, you know, k after big L number of layers. This function, its functional form depends on L. So that's one place where depth plays a role. And if you imagined this is something that you want to diagonalize, you want to find its eigenfunctions and eigenvalues, which is, you know, you want to solve a lot of the information content of this kind of operator is by solving, coming from solving this equation. So these basis functions and the eigenvalues then therefore also depend on depth. But then in practice, when you go and you evaluate for some of these networks, so different architectures will have different recursion relationships and different functional forms. For some architectures, you find that actually, of course, even though manifestly it looks like it has a different functional form, it doesn't make much of a difference in the numerics. And nobody, to my knowledge, has studied this theoretically yet too much to be able to say that maybe effectively the eigenfunctions don't change that much, et cetera. And so that's an area that people could maybe work on a little bit theoretically. The role of depth and finite width, and especially in this learning rate phase diagram, we don't understand yet. Yeah, so depth, taking any limits that involve depth or depth and width scaling, I think are open. Very much, theoretically and empirically.
Okay, I think it's a good time to stop. Let's thank Jasmine again.